5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Suppose it's working. Oh, it is.
Where were we?
That's what I was about to ask you.
I've lost track.
No, I lost track.
For the moment.
Oh, we were talking about the mystic and the Negro.
The split.
In Du Bois.
Yeah.
Now, what was your question on that?
Well, what do you feel about that?
Well, I think the two experiences of my husband and I might be illustrative of the type of thing that Du Bois is talking about. Now, my feeling in Africa was one of complete identification, feeling of going home, you know, being at home, and that I really had found my roots, you know, and all of that. Well, now, my husband had none of that at all. Africa was just like going to South America or India or some other place to him, Europe. So now, right here within my own family is maybe a frustration of the sort of thing you're talking about.
Well, how would that feeling, your feeling for Africa, the sense of home, mm-hmm. relate to your activity toward an integrated, free society here, which possibly means the loss of identity as Negro?
Yes, yes.
How do those feelings square?
Yes. We'll come back to that.
All right.
Well, I can say this. It being a feeling of home did not mean that I wanted to return there to remain.
Yes.
It just felt, it made me feel that I had finally touched base and that I had, you know, put my feet down solid on what my roots were. But it is from this point I would want to move forward. And this would mean integration, this would mean working, even if I were in Africa, for the abundant life for all men and all people. And it certainly would mean this in American life. You see, I see my feeling about mankind is that we are all, no matter what race we are, children of God. And that He wants us all to have abundant life, whatever it means. Whatever the abundant life means for you, whatever it means for me, based on what our individual personalities are, our backgrounds, our roots, and so forth. So I want to work for that wherever I am. And it's not a matter of feeling that because Africa gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of kinship and a sense of being at home and a sense of finding my roots, that I just want to sit down on those laurels.
You wouldn't interpret it then as a movement toward Negro exclusiveness.
No.
Something approximating
oh, no.
the
oh,
Muslim.
No, or the Garveyites, no.
Or the Garveyites,
no.
Anything like
no.
that.
No, no. Not at all.
You would find your solution in terms of Christian religion then, is that right?
Yes, I do. The way I interpret it, yes. And even and more than that, because, I mean, this could be, let's say the Judeo-Christian tradition, because many persons that I work with are Jewish, you see. And then I've worked with people who are non-believers, for that matter. Certainly in the peace movement, many people are non-believers. Some of them are agnostics and some of them atheists, you see. But I see it from the framework of God's relationship to all of His children.
Speaking of Jews, several Jews have said to me about this question of the split in the, or possible split,
yes.
in the Negro psyche, but they have the same thing. Mm-hmm. On one hand,
Israel.
The identity as Jew,
yes.
on the other hand, the impulse to move in to the mainstream of
yes.
American life,
yes.
and lose the exclusiveness, even lose the Jewish heritage, perhaps.
Yes. Well, you see, I feel that you may, in the natural process of moving in, lose a lot of it. But I think if you are aware of what your background is, and you have respect and admiration for it. I think the split in the psyche comes when a person wants to move away from what his past was and does not have respect for it and doesn't admire it, and therefore he's trying to be absorbed by another thing. It's not that with me. It's recognizing what my past is as a member of a Negro minority with relationship and roots in Africa. But it's also working with all of the races so that everybody gets their place in the sun.
Do you see a parallelism between this problem for those Negroes for whom it is a problem?
Yes.
And the problem of a Mississippian or other Southerners who on one hand feel the impulse to enter the mainstream of American life and who are committed to that in a way, yet who stand back defending some exclusiveness, some presumably necessary Southern heritage, a split of that sort that Myrdal talks about and many others talk about.
Yeah, I guess
a division of loyalties there.
Yes, I guess there is a parallel. But you see, I don't think it, I mean, although Myrdal is saying this and Du Bois said it, and it does happen with people, I don't think it necessarily has to happen. I don't think one, you have to exclude one or the other.
Yes, I understand your point of view.
That's what I'm trying
to say. Many Southerners are in the position, I should think, of the Negro who cannot reconcile these two impulses.
Yes.
He also is in a split position.
That's right. Absolutely. Because he said in, like black and white, was that Dyckman, study black and white, anyway, that it was like spitting on the grave. He really didn't believe all of this, but it was like spitting on the grave of his grandfather if he didn't act as though he believed into it and lived up to these Southern traditions and so forth.
Yes, so that's not an uncommon
this is a
thing to find.
Yes. Why is this? Well, of course, Southerners, as Martin says, are just diehard. So anyway, I was about to ask, why do they feel this tremendous tug of tradition on them? Because part of it, of course, is the whole isolationism of people living in the South anyway, because they're isolated on issues of peace, they're isolated in economics, they're isolated in race, and this is a whole reflection, isn't it?
They feel themselves a deprived minority, many of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Have the psychology of a deprived minority.
Mm-hmm.
The same psychology that can be found in any minority.
Oh, yeah.
This complicated by defeated nationalism.
Yes.
I suppose.
Yes. And it puts them in a defensive position.
Now my next thought, question, stemming from that would be this. Do you see any chance for Southerners you know to keep their Southernness, their sense of loyalty to a personal heritage, and lose the Negro prejudice? Or is the Negro prejudice a necessary part of the Southern heritage, or only an accidental part of the Southern heritage? You see what I'm getting at? I'm not saying it well, but I think I'm blundering at something anyway.
Yes, I think I understand what you're saying. You're saying if they are going to hold on to what they believe is their Southern tradition and so forth, isn't the matter of prejudice and race a natural part of that?
Yes, so they have to hang on to it. Or can I say Thomas Jefferson was a Southerner too?
Yes.
Or Robert E. Lee was a Southerner too.
Well, let's say this. I would feel that there are good and bad things about any tradition, Southern or what have you. And why not hang on to whatever the rich, best positive things are of one's tradition and let go of the negative things? And I think that this race thing is one of the negative things. Then the other thing I would say is that it hasn't always been race prejudice as a part of the Southern tradition. It's just been a failure to recognize that this servant, this slave who has become a servant, is a part of a people's and not a part of a thing. It's not a thing which they own individually and which they love like they do their dog or their cat or their horse, you see, but that he's a part of a race that has history and tradition and so forth, and therefore he is to be respected as an individual. And I think this is a growth process that a person has to go through. So I would say that I don't think it has to be a part of something that one holds on to.
Here's something related to that on the side of the Negro situation. Sometimes I hear it said, or read it, that the Negro has a great liability, not merely imposed from the outside, but a self-imposed liability in using the deprivations imposed on him by history and by the present society as a kind of constant alibi and a constant excuse for self-pity.
Yes.
Of course, I don't mean everyone does it.
No,
as a human trait anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But how would you assess that? Do you see that actually working around you?
Oh, yes. Yes. I think a lot of people, you know, excuse things on the basis of, I think, as you say, it's a human trait to try to find an excuse, and this is a good one, as good a thing as any. Poor me.
It's a clearly...
Look
how
I've been treated and so forth. But I think we're getting away from it. So.
You think there's a real change on that
basis?
Oh,
yes, definitely.
Do you associate that change with the civil rights movement?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I don't think your young people would do any of that at all. But they would recognize the fact that they had been deprived and neglected and so forth, but they're going to make this jump. Just like the African nations. Ghana, for example, are making a 200-year jump in 20 years, they hope to do.
This puts us at freedom now.
Yes, then. That's right.
The content of the word freedom, the phrase freedom now, let's come at that for a moment. Let me read something, may I first, a quotation. This is from Dr. Hancock, written several years ago now, the Negro sociologist historian. Quotation is this: the color question is a social problem and as such is not different from any other social problem, and by reason of this fact it responds to the same processes of adjustment or maladjustment. Social problems by their very nature do not lend themselves to instantaneous and absolute solutions. You see, this is one pole of a discussion.
Yes.
But that's at one end of the discussion, and freedom now at the other end. Where would we come out?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me the freedom now means that you must have a box, in a way, a frame, that indicates freedom now for all people, like the civil rights legislation. And you'll find that people move into that frame and take their pictures, places in the picture pretty easily once the frame is set. When I first started traveling out of Jackson, Mississippi, the only way I could get a Pullman reservation is that an attorney, Negro doctor, attorney friend of ours, would call the station master here and say that my friend's daughter has to go such and such a place and it's too long for her to sit up, let her have a berth. And then I would get what they call lower 13, the whole parlor car, the whole bedroom for the price of a lower, you know, and so forth, and had to have all my meals. Well, then came the decision that people could eat in the diner, and then you got in the diner, but you ate behind the curtains, you see. And then later the curtains were removed and you didn't find many people starving and not eating because they had to eat seat at a table, the Negroes were there. Well, you see, the frame was set, the box was put there, and they moved into it very, very well and very easily.
Excuse me, please.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, because I'm not explaining it clearly. Go ahead.
I think I'm following it.
All right, go ahead, ask me.
I was going to try to paraphrase it to be sure that I did. If I haven't got it right, please tell me. That you would recognize time process, either short or long
process.
But in terms of clearly formulated objectives and a clear movement toward those objectives, is that it?
That's it. That there must be action immediately and positively, and that has teeth in it.
But that the effects are clearly taking a long or short time, is that right?
Yes.
It can't be, there's no absolute solution.
No, no. And that time, and I want to say this, that I said before, not to you, that I don't think time is the issue. People are always saying, oh, but it takes time.
Please develop that.
To do such and such. That's not the issue. The issue is whatever the particular thing is that we're talking about. And then we see what happens as to time. But I think there's much too much emphasis put on the fact that it takes time to do this, takes time to do this. I don't have time to do this, you know. And this is perfectly irrelevant, it seems to me. The thing is, does this need changing? Let's change it. How do we go about changing it and so forth? And then you may find that it will take some time afterwards for people to accept it. Just today, for example, I'm talking about the fact that now the people can register and vote, but they're not doing it, you see. Well, now, it shouldn't have been, they have put the emphasis in the right place. They've gotten it so that people can do it. Now you work to move people faster into the particular thing, you see. And the concern wasn't on the fact that it takes time, therefore we won't move fast because it takes time, and we will slow it down because it takes time. You see, you forget that. Leave that out and let time fall in where it should. I mean, where it does. Does that make sense?
It certainly does to me. It does indeed. But I have seen people sit in the same room, and one say, freedom now means now.
Mm-hmm.
And another person say, well, it's all historical process. Let's withdraw from the effort.
Yeah.
These two poles, of the, both of which I think are nonsense.
Yeah, that's right.
But people, intelligent people, hold them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. You see, I guess you're seeing in the thing that I say that I'm a sort of a blender.
Yes.
But I don't feel that the things are mutually exclusive, you know, as people try to make them, that you've got to be at either poles, that there are always of reconciling the elements in each and pulling them together so that you move forward, and that your major concern should be the forward move.
I see. That's a purely practical view of the matter, then. Use what you can and do what you can.
Yeah, yeah. And know where you're going.
That's
right. And take the steps to get to there.
Let me ask you two questions about Negro relations to the civil rights movement, or to the whole question of the betterment of the Negro situation. Some time ago I read Dr. Mays, Benjamin Vase, on this matter that I'm going to mention. I've read other things like the Pittsburgh Courier, Mr. Prattis, in that, on the same subject. The fact that there's the Negro philanthropy or Negro contributions to the causes of Negro life runs behind their actual assets.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
This is and I've asked most recently, say, people in New Orleans.
Yes.
And they would say, well, most of our financing comes from whites.
Yes.
This is a strange situation, isn't it, on the face of it? There clearly to be good natural reasons for it.
Yes.
Now, how would you explain that?
Yes. Well,
what are those reasons?
Well, let's see now. And because there's several reasons. I think one, perhaps major reason, is that the struggle has been so hard for so many Negroes that when they personally individual. Let me back up and say, the first reason is a characteristic of peoples anywhere, purely selfish reason why they are not contributing in large amount. When they individually have gotten over the hump of education and been able to get into a financial, economic, secure place, then they want to bathe themselves in the results of their efforts or the efforts of their family. And this means the split-level house, the Cadillac car, and I have a Cadillac car, but I have it because we're in the film business and the public demands it. This means the fur stoves. This means all the status symbols and all the things that I couldn't have, all the things I saw the white lady wearing when I was a maid in her home, all the things that Mr. Bob gave his wife when I was portering or gardening in his yard. And I said, whenever I was able to do it, I was going to do it for my wife too, you see. So it's getting this, you see, this taste of something when they've had nothing. It's a short-term thing because it means that they lose sight of the fact that when they individually have arrived, in quotes, arrived in quotes, according to America's materialistic standards, that they still have not arrived unless all the other people have arrived, white and Negro too, who are deprived, you see. And that the only way that you help all of them is by sharing what you have rather than pouring it on yourself.
The comparison sometimes made between the Negro communities on this basis and Jewish communities.
Yes.
That's the common comparison.
Yes, yes, and the Jewish do differently, don't they?
Well, the statistics would indicate that.
They do differently. They help themselves more. Is that it?
That's the idea. Give more.
Yes.
Or
yes.
Not only to Jewish philanthropists,
yes,
but to general philanthropists,
yes,
in relation to their income.
Yes.
One point, I suppose, is this. See what you think of it. That the humanly, things are very similar. But the Jew has never felt the kind of deprivation. This is not in our historical time. He's had terrible things happen to him,
yeah,
say, in Russia or Germany and elsewhere.
Yeah.
But the sense of having, at least looking back on grandeurs,
mm-hmm,
then looking back on the temple in Jerusalem, is there to look back on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the modern fortune is not as new as the modern fortune
to the Negro
who doesn't look back on the temple in Jerusalem.
That's right. That's true.
There's some image there behind the Jew's mind which is not there in the ordinary Negro's mind.
That's right. And also he's working from a base of not the kind of nose to the grind. Well, yes, he works.
Some do, of course.
Yes. But I think, by and large, wouldn't this be true in the Jewish group, that their economic average as a Jewish group is higher than the economic average in the Negro group?
Yes, he does not feel as excluded as a Negro. Even though he was poor on the day of arrival at Ellis Island.
That's right.
He had more hope.
That's right. And he had more opportunity.
Had more opportunity.
That's right.
Both.
Than the Negro. But the Negro has been right down there, you see, right down there in the dirt, and working in the dirt, and sweating in. So that when he gets his nose above it, he thinks of himself first. I'm not defending, understand?
No.
Because I have very little patience for my friends who, I couldn't. They wanted me to be a part of the links, which they have a charter group started here. There. And I met with them a while, and then got right up to the organization, and I couldn't go ahead with it because here it meant the links in the Negro groups is synonymous with mink, you know,
yeah,
mink, you know. And here it's a matter of going to somebody's house, and I spend $40, $60, $100 feeding the group this time, and you do that, and then we say that. well, they have something of a program, you see. But to me, this is just wasted time, energy, and money, you know, and all the rest of it. And I'm very critical of my friends who can think only of themselves and pushing themselves forward, because I think this thing has got to be broad-based, you know, if we are to get forward. So that I'm not defending.
Well, I understand.
At all.
What about the other factor that's sometimes mentioned, that the Jew, however depressed and deprived, was aware of an organized cultural community behind him?
Mm-hmm. I think
had an organized tradition behind him.
Yes, yes. And an organized tradition around him, which we don't have in the Negro.
Yes.
See, which we haven't had. The only little thing we've had has been the NAACP.
And the church organization.
And the church, yes. And the church. The church has gotten weaker and weaker from the standpoint of helping, you know. I think back as a child that the barrel societies in the churches were very strong, and now you don't have them very much because there isn't a need for it now, because Negroes can buy insurance and take care of their needs. But the church did something. But you see, again, they didn't have as much of a pile of economic resources out of which to work the Jewish group did.
Sure.
You see?
Sure.
And I think that this is, I think you've got to say where you're starting from, you know.
Yes, there were no Rothschilds among the Negroes at the same time.
No. And you don't, even now, your wealthy Negroes, you are down at the bottom of the heap compared to a lot of your Jewish people.
That brings in two more questions that are sometimes discussed. One is this: how much lack of communication, lack of rapport, and sense of responsibility on the part of the educated, sort of middle, upper class of Negroes is compared to the masses of Negroes, the bottom of the heap?
Yeah. Well,
how much of a split is there?
Yeah.
Talked about how important is that split?
Well, I think the gap is closing. I think you're getting more intelligent middle-class Negroes who are interested in the total American economy and the total struggle of a Negro than you had, say, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even. I think your most courageous people, though, are the people that are down on the bottom of the heap in the Negro group, the ones you saw today out at the meeting.
Yes.
Because the hardest group to move are the teachers who have economic security. They skirt, you know, go around. And at Woman Power Unlimited, we have a few who come and work, but they don't know whether they're going to have their jobs next year. But they, at the place now where they don't care, you see, they believe enough in what's happening to do it. So I think the gap is closing.
It's closing.
I think the gap is closing. Again, if you want to go back to time, it's not closing fast enough for me.
Yes, yes.
But our hope is in our masses, and that man that you saw today who couldn't speak the English at all. Where are the real guts are?
That was very touching.
Yeah.
It's very touching.
But if you could have sat in that meeting all day today, you know, you really would have gotten some moving things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can go to some of these civil rights hearings, you really will get to, and you get down to, as I say, the nitty-gritty.
Yes. As a corollary of the question I just asked, there is the one, well, I'll read a quotation from Roy Otley.
Yeah.
Many Negroes.
One of his books?
Yes, this is one of his books.
Which book?
Oh,
Black
Eye? New World of Coming.
Oh, yes.
Many of them look with alarm, this is many Negroes,
mm-hmm.
upon a world where they must compete with whites and thus lose their unique situation or status.
Mm-hmm.
They prefer, as one Negro observer remarks, the overvaluation of their achievements and its position behind the walls of segregation, to a democratic order that would result in economic and social devaluation for themselves at that time. Now, he follows, though, by saying this. Nevertheless, this group, whatever its shortcomings, has provided the race's economic and cultural progress and constitutes the leavening group in the general population.
I agree with you.
To the both things.
Yeah.
Is that changing in your observation?
I hope it's changing. I think the younger Negro is more ready to compete across lines with anybody, anywhere. And I think the very fact that friends' children are going to prep schools in the East indicates they're preparing their children for the total society where they must compete anywhere.
That the protection of segregation is no longer important to the, quote, privileged Negro. He doesn't want to be protected, have his benefits only inside the wall of segregation. Or his status, he's ready to compete, willing to compete.
A large percentage of them are.
Well, it would not be universal at any time, any
place. Well, I don't want to indicate that this is a black and white thing, that it has changed completely over this way. But I think the move is in that direction, to compete, be able to compete with anyone, anywhere, on any level, and get from behind the wall. It's something to give up segregation. There are advantages to it, definitely. If we take my business, the film business, for example, one of the reasons that we've been able to do as well as we have in the film business is because we could only serve Negroes, you see. And the Negroes weren't going to the white film home, so that didn't siphon off people to the other community. But with this thing coming, who knows? Maybe you can just choose your funeral home, you know.
Mr. Augustine told me yesterday, when I was having lunch with him, he said, the fact that the Hilton has opened up in New Orleans means that many Negro caterers are being very badly hit.
I can imagine.
But they have actually organized and made protests to the Negro community for patronizing the non-segregated restaurant facilities. And he said there's some comedy in this.
Yes, there is. There definitely is. But these are the things that you must be aware of when you fight to open these doors. You got to realize you got to pay the price for them being open, you know.
Yes.
And that means a loss of some things to you that you've enjoyed. And this is a thing that our mayor hammers on quite a bit, he tells the Negro teachers. You see, if you get these integrated schools, look at all the jobs that you have now. And all the money that you get, you won't be getting this anymore. But you see, the thing that we're working for is a step beyond that, where everybody will have a place. Not all of the Negro teachers who are working now, because all of them don't need to be working now. Many of them are teaching now because there was nothing else for them to do, and they would be much better qualified doing something else. But we are looking for the time when there will be integrated schools at every level, students and faculty in the high schools and the junior high schools all across town, you see. And not that just Negroes would be knocked out of jobs and just white people employed, you see.
The president of the Negro Business Association, the association in St. Louis a few years ago, wrote an article in St. Louis paper saying that to encourage integration would be the death of Negro business.
Mm-hmm. Well,
do you find an attitude around here?
No, not in Jackson.
Not in Jackson.
Not yet, because we're too far away from that.
Probably.
You see, St. Louis is a border
line,
and that would be more true there. But I see I face that fact, and it will happen for some businesses. But the thing that I say to our staff here is that we want to be so qualified that we can serve anybody who comes at any time, so then you don't fear.
Except the competition.
No.
That
because we don't want to operate a Negro business, we want to operate a business that will serve anybody who wants to come. And if you do that sort of thing, some of them are going to be knocked out, and some are going to flourish, because then they will attract more than just one segment of the community. Yes, some people are going to be lost in the shuffle individually and business-wise. This is just natural. And you've got to face up to this as a reality. But if you've got the stuff, you know, to offer, and the stuff within you, you'll make the grade.
The same problem, reaching out unafraid of the competition.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
We all know a lot about the white man's stereotype of the Negro. What about the Negro stereotype of the white man?
You mean, what is it?
What is
or
it? What
is
it? Well, is there? If so, what is it?
Oh, yes. Oh, there are definite stereotypes. I mean, prejudice didn't just find its way into one race. Prejudice is universal among all people. And I think in the Negro group, it takes the form of feeling that the white man is dishonest and that he's two-faced. Is this the sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. What his picture of the white man is.
Yes.
Even his contradictory elements, of course.
There's
a contradictory element in the white man's view of the Negro.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, these are parts of the facets of it, and that he feels uncomfortable. I mean, one of the contributions I try to make to the community, in my avocational interest, rather than my business interest too, is to develop leadership. I try to do it in the businesses from the standpoint that I can move in and out, and yet we are offering the same service whether I'm here or whether I'm not, because people are so trained to do that. In the community, I try to do it within the framework of the women's movement, in that other women learn to accept leadership roles and carry them out and perform them well and do it, because this is the way I feel that a community grows, not with just one person doing everything, but many people being trained and to learn to do things. I've said so much, I've lost your question. I've said so much about background. What was the question?
It was about the Negro stereotype of the white man.
Yes. So that in doing this, helping develop these leadership roles, another thing that I've tried to do is to establish communication across racial lines. And this is where our interracial prayer fellowship got started 2 years ago, which continues here in Jackson through Woman Power Unlimited, United Church Women, and a AME prayer band group, African Methodist Episcopal Church prayer band. And the Negro women will say to me, again, communication, in these workshops that we've had the past 3 Sundays, these have been interracial workshops where we've had Millsap faculty people and white people from the community and Negro people sitting down discussing these issues and raising questions about it. And the Negro women will tell me, do you think so-and-so is really, you know, sincere? Do you think they're really honest, you know? Do they really mean, or are they just grinning in our face, you see? So that this is very real, and I think that the only way that they can overcome it, white or Negro, is by some face-to-face contact and getting to know people better. A good example of it is Mrs. Jane Scott, whom you should really talk to. She's white. Whom I've gotten to know in the last 2 years, and Mrs. Horton, who's Negro, Mrs. Tilly, you know, Mrs. Tilly in Atlanta, which wanted some Negro woman to come to the Fellowship of the Concern 2 years ago. This was October 61, following our work with the Freedom Riders, and someone told Mrs. Scott to call me and invite me to come, and I couldn't accept, and I told her I'd get one of our Woman Power ladies to you. So I got Mrs. Horton, who is the wife of the AME minister. Well, Mrs. Horton had very little interracial contact and very little leadership responsibility herself. She pushed her husband, and he, you know, was in the forefront, but she'd never done much. But he agreed that she should go and so forth. So she, M.G. Horton and Jane Scott came back and started this interracial prayer fellowship, which continues. And this has been a tremendous growth experience for these two women to get to know each other as sisters, and they love each other, you know. And they now they go to United Church Women meetings together. They share the room together. They've brought in other white women into the experience of knowing each other. This is the only way you're going to do it, you know. Is get them together and get them to see that the one doesn't have horns and one doesn't lie and cheat and steal and smell bad and all the rest, as they say it is.
What is the economic, social background of Mrs. Scott? She is white, you said.
Yes, she's white. Her husband is an engineer, and they are Episcopalians, and she would be middle income. She's not in the top economic bracket, but she has been president of the advisory committee to the Civil Rights Commission, and her background growth has come United Church Women, what gave her her springboard, and then her other growth, her great growth, has come and her association with us in Woman Power Unlimited, because I've seen her grow in these 2 years to a place that, where she was used to be just debating, you know, whether this, that, the other, and so forth, and now she has real convictions about what she should do and how she should move.
I was about to talk myself, I don't want to now. I'll do it later. Myrdal has a little passage in his big book on what should have been done in the Reconstruction, what policy would have been effective.
To have prevented all this.
To prevent the whole, what would have been the effective policy?
Yeah.
So 4 or 5 points, I'll summarize them very briefly and ask you a question. One, there should have been compensation for emancipation.
Yes.
Two, land should have been expropriated from southern white landholders, but it should have been paid for at a reasonable rate.
Yeah.
Three, the land should have been turned over to the ex-slaves.
Yeah.
This enough to, for a great amount. But this should not have been a gift, a sale at some very minimal rate, but actually to be amortized over many years.
Yeah.
Four, there should have been supervision and education in the transitional period to prevent exploitation, people's buying land and selling land, stealing it away, and to develop techniques. Again, some transportation, that is to free lands of the West and colonizing out of the South to open up, to relieve the pressures and redistribute the Negro population to a degree. Does all of that make sense to you?
Very good sense to me.
All of it.
Yes.
There's no emotional resistance to any one of those. Any
not
one
to
of
me.
Those.
No.
The reason I ask is this: sometimes, as it was at that time, a Northerner or a Negro would say, "Why compensate for emancipation? Or why compensate for land from rebels?" You know those arguments.
Yes.
Well, I sometimes find resistance now on those points.
I see. I think that the fact that the Reconstruction period was just such a hit-and-miss thing where anybody did whatever they wanted to and all of that, and nobody had any guidance or leadership is one of the great tragedies that's causing what we have now. I think there had been some planning and some real thought, creative thought, put into what you do now that your decision is made that we wouldn't have to be going through what we're going through now. There might have been other ideas to add to the ones that Myrdal has outlined, but I think that basically his thesis is absolutely correct.
But it's strange how you will find resistances 100 years later on some theoretical point
whether
rebels should have their land paid for.
Well, you see, you start thinking, you're not thinking of people, you see, you're thinking of a label, rebel.
Yes,
You see. And this is the thing that you want to get away with. You're thinking of people. You rebel slave, you see.
That's right.
And you see, if you talk in those terms and you think that way, Then, of course, you build up your prejudices and your resistances. But they were people, they were dispossessed people, they were dispossessed whites, they were dispossessed Negroes, they were dispossessed people. And how do you treat human beings who have gone through a serious, traumatic experience like a civil war? What's the right Christian thing to do for them? Justice, most just thing that you can do for them? And this is the way I think it's thinking.
The problem really appears again, doesn't it? That the picture of what will come after, say, legislative battles,
yes.
Legal battles have been
yes.
won,
yes.
is the big problem, isn't
That's
it?
That's right. That's absolutely right. The fact that even now, after the waiting rooms have opened, people are still going into the same waiting rooms, and they're still going to the back of the bus, you see. This they've done so long, they still do. And you've got to have this leadership to help them see that you don't continue to still do it the way you used to do. You've got to do it a different way. And when the Civil Rights Bill is passed in Congress, you need to have good, concerted efforts to see that its implementation is done immediately and that you don't get this lag that you got after the Supreme Court decision. Because if you do, you're going to have the same types of problems that you had following it.
There's another aspect to it, too. Suppose you have many Birminghams. What possibility of communication comes after that?
Yeah, yeah.
How can you avoid the Birminghams?
Yeah, that's
so a society can be built afterwards.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's what I hope in Jackson, that we can afford avoid the Birminghams. And yet I don't know how.
The young lady, Lucy Thornton, that I spoke of
yes.
earlier, did we put that on the tape or not?
No, we didn't.
Well, her remark...
You told me she was a student.
She's a student at Howard University, second in the law class.
Mm-hmm.
She said to me, I have some real hope about the adjustment, the solution in the South. And she told me she had been born on a farm and raised on a farm in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and rather... deprived circumstances, mm-hmm. she led me to believe. But she said, I have great hope of a solution here and a society that will be agreeable to live in afterward and very soon.
Mm-hmm.
She said, because the Southern white man and the Negro have both had a common history for a long time. So there's some basis for comprehension, mutual comprehension. She said, there's some.
Yeah.
And follow that line of thought. So we are both on the land and in the history together.
Yes.
She said, I'm afraid of Harlem. I'm afraid of Detroit.
Yes. Yes.
Because I don't see what can bind them together when the big bang comes
That's
later.
That's right. I'd agree with it.
Does that make sense?
And this is what I was talking about a while ago when I said I hope the South could point the way for these others rather than the North giving the solution for the South. I think that we have more common bonds that will help us point the way. And we have the depth of the problem. And if we can solve it here and get some solutions here, I think it'll be much easier for Harlem and the North. And then we have a bond of affection among us in the South that is very real. It's a personal thing where the white loves, the whites love a particular Negro. Or the Negro loves a particular white family, but it's real. It's genuine.
Sometimes now, Negroes will say that it cannot be real, it cannot exist, it's only a fake.
No, it's not fake. It's not fake when not the things that...
You know that line of thought, though, has always been a fake. There's no possibility of any human affection between... You know that's being said very widely now, it's all a fake.
Well, I don't feel that at all. I know that there wasn't universal love in all cases, as we just said before, and that I know that a lot of times a Negro in the home that whites said they just love me to death, the Negroes didn't just love them to death. Yeah, they did love them to death, and all of that. But I also know that there is But there has been a lot of love between white and Negroes in the South. And it hadn't always been on the Southern case. It has even existed in the man, a male-female relationship. That wasn't all exploitation. It was that there was no law that would permit the marriage. And I know right in my own association, a girlfriend of mine, who you would never know that she was a Negro. When we would go as children uptown here, people just would stare sick, you know. Her father was the pastor of the Methodist Church here, and her mother, and they both were fair. And I didn't know until I was grown how the fairness came, but a British land overseer was in love with her grandmother, and out of this issue came these children. And he, when he was going back to Britain, he wanted to take this Negro woman and his child with him to England, but she felt that being Negro that they would not be accepted and so forth, so she chose to stay here. But he would have honored it if he could have left. And this was true in many cases. Then another thing that is something that you don't see in a textbook, which is just personal, purely on my part, that all of it wasn't exploitation by the male white with the Negro female. And a lot of those gals just made it too so hard on the poor fellow that they couldn't do any better, you know. And a lot of times they did it out of resentment at the white woman. Maybe something she did or said, and she said, I'll fix him, I'll fix her, I'll get him tonight, you know, so forth. So this was too many. People were human,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I said that to a Negro group in our workshop the other day. I didn't say it in the workshop, but a girl raised a question, a Negro girl raised a question and said, how did Southern white women feel when they knew that their husbands were going out and sleeping with someone in the quarters and so forth? And how much had this affected some of the problems and so forth? And some white man in the workshop deigned to answer it, white lady too. So I told her afterwards, I said, you must realize that this wasn't all exploitation by the white male with the Negro female, that the Negro female sometimes was guilty too, you know, just knowing people.
Yes. You can depend on that.
Yeah.
Whatever the motives were.
Yes, yes, just knowing people.
Here's Arnold Rose, the collaborator of Mia Darling.
Oh, yes,
you know,
yes, that's right.
Another book. Negroes have too many problems to ever be happy. They are always seeking something. They use too many nostrums, join too many organizations, fall under the spell of too many movements. They are thus among the extreme victims of modern mass society and its instability. Big generalization, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
Is there some sense to it, though? Or if so, you know, how much or what? Or is that more true of Northern society, Northern Negro society, and Southern Negro society?
That's what I was thinking.
Really?
I was thinking of the Negro cults when you in the North, which have posed as churches and what have you, but have been able to suck up whole masses of people because of the frustration of the people there. And they have become victims of it. And then I think of the Black Muslim movement and so forth. I think it would be more true in the North and the South. And because, you see, the Negro, as you're aware, went north with such tremendous hopes. He thought that the kingdom had come on earth and that he would find it there. And then he got there and he was just, he knew it wasn't here, you see. And he didn't expect it here. But when he went there and didn't find it, and found it even a lot of times it was a lot worse than he had experienced it here, from the standpoint of the fact that it required more money to operate, and he was having to live in an apartment with infested rats and so forth. Whereas at least here, maybe he lived in a shack, but he could get out in the sunshine and he could have a little garden and have fresh vegetables and so forth. So therefore, it became much worse for him. The frustration was so much greater, you see. Then the pace was so great, you see. He came from a slow-moving Southern society, you know, and then you had to jump, you know, everything. And so he became, and therefore did become a victim of a lot of. But I think it's a great generalization, and whatever truth lies in it, I would say, would apply to the Northern Negro remnant.
He says the mass society is if it, something of a big city, I guess he has in mind, rather than even a Southern city.
Yes.
Let me tell you a little anecdote. Back to Howard University.
Mm-hmm.
One of the speakers, one of the panels, in an enormous auditorium, like the auditorium this morning, big, 1,500 people, no standing room.
Yeah.
It was packed, three quarters at least, maybe four-fifths of Negroes in the audience. Mm-hmm. This young girl, her name is, I forget her first name, Wheeler, Phi Beta Kappa, senior, has been through the mill, through the jails, skin as pale as mine.
Mm-hmm.
She has great vital appeal, real projection. She's a real orator. Very, very attractive looking girl with this intensity of, quivering intensity. She said her first words, "I have a great truth, a great discovery. I have a joy. I am black." This brought a moment of,
and
she held it for a moment. Now you, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you, you see, you have an audience of every possible shade of complexion, you see. You're all white. Your skin may be this or that, but your heart is white. Your brain is white. You've been whitewashed. You don't know the joy. Brought down the house. This was a high point of the whole conference as far as popular response was concerned.
Yes. Yes. I can see that.
Well, that's, what's the moral of that story?
Well, I don't know.
That gets us back to the question of the Mother Africa and the and the the black mystique, doesn't it?
Yes. I don't know that I could comment on the moral of it, but I was thinking, as you told it, about talking, I know who it was, with one of our fellow faculty wives. The other evening when you were there in Baton Rouge, we had to do some things together, and I was saying what a great joy it is to be a Negro and to be black, because at least I don't have to carry the burden of guilt for all the things that have happened in race relations. And she was telling about how her children, who are now 8 and 11, had grown up in an integrated community, and they didn't understand anything about the race problem. And they had said, her daughter had said, I don't want to be black, I want to be white. And the grandmother had heard this, you know. And the grandmother had died with this on her mind, that here she was rearing her grandchild not to respect her race and to love it and so forth, and because the child was very young and didn't have understanding. But the grandmother was wanting her to know what a joy it is to accept what you are.
That's a universal human.
Yes.
Accepting what you are is different from...
And what your heritage is.
And that. I mean, that's different, though, is it, from exclusiveness?
Oh, yes.
Back where we started.
Oh, yes.
But this was, had an element.
She was not being exclusive, the one you told about. Was she?
I don't know. She was driving for simply the acceptance.
Oh, yes.
But clearly some of the response was in terms of exclusiveness and in terms of black Muslim attitude.
I'm
sure some of it came out that way.
Oh, I see.
And I was sitting, and a person I just met a few minutes before was a young woman who's a professor of anthropology there.
Yes.
And she's white.
Yes.
And she said, for the first time in my life teaching, all of her life's been teaching in Negro universities.
Yes.
So for the first time right now, I feel it's, I feel lost.
Mm-hmm.
I feel I haven't made contact.
Yes, yes, yes.
She really, she it didn't reflect on me so much. I didn't feel it this way. But
yes.
She really had a real sense of
yes.
Shivers.
Yes.
And exclusiveness and cut off from communication.
I didn't get it that way when you told me. But I was seeing it out of context.
It's hard to know what, no, clearly everybody didn't hear the same thing.
No, no.
But she brought down the house.
Yes, sir.
Nothing had been like that.
No.
You know, you said you had to go at 4:30.
Well,
after
suppose
4:30
we
now.
Have cut off now. Now, if you don't have what you want, we could take a little while tomorrow if you want to.
Well, this has been wonderful. This is just couldn't have been better. Just couldn't have been better. I may write, if I had my way and had, all the time in the world, I would certainly take you up on tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends on what time.
Oh,
you see Mr. Moses, I haven't got a date with him.
Oh, you haven't?
No. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've seen him. I've written to him, he didn't answer.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that. If I had realized that, I would have let you make
he was in control of the meeting.
I know, but Dr. Henry had come in then, you could have cleared that. He wouldn't
have. Well, I'm clear with.
No, but I mean, Dr. Henry had come in to preside.
Oh, I see. I didn't get that.
Yes,
see.
He had come in to preside.
That.
See, Moses was just handling it until Henry.
Oh, I see.
Because you know, when Henry got there, he said, "This is typical for a chairman to be late for a meeting."
Yes, yes.
You
yes,
remember?
Yes, yes.
Yes. So that you might have called him.
Oh,
Moses
I see. Well, how could I get in touch with him? You know.
I don't know how you'd get in touch with him today, except out there. But his office is on Lynn Street.
It's 10-7-10.
10-7-10.
Is he in the phone book?
Yes, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
It is, I see.
So that what I would suggest that you do is tomorrow morning is when you move out that way to, if you don't reach